Welcome and thank you for standing by. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. During the question and answer session, you may press star one on your phone if you would like to ask a question. Today's conference is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. Now I would like to turn the meeting over to Ms. Lauren Gatchis. You may begin.
Thank you. Good morning, everyone, and thanks for joining us for the announcement of NOAA's Spring Outlook and Flood Risk for 2019. My name is Lauren Gatchis, and I'm the media contact for the Spring Outlook. You can reach me by an email at lauren.gatchis@noaa.gov. That is lauren.gatchis@noaa.gov, and by phone at 301-683-1327 at the conclusion of today's call. The news release and maps related to today's announcement are now available on noaa.gov. Today's media teleconference will begin with remarks from our experts for about 15 minutes, and then we'll take questions from reporters. The NOAA experts with me today to talk about the spring outlook are Mary Erickson, Deputy Director of the National Weather Service, Ed Clark, Director of the National Water Center in Tuscaloosa, Alabama, John Gottschalk, Chief of the Operational Prediction Branch at NOAA's Climate Prediction Center, and we're also joined by Dr. Daniel Kanuski, Deputy Administrator for Resilience at FEMA. With that, I will turn it over to Mary.
Good morning. I'd like to echo Lauren's welcome to the reporters joining us on the phone. Thank you for listening in for today's important announcement. And a special thank you, too, to our guest, Dan Kanuski of FEMA, for joining us. Our scientists at NOAA produced this spring outlook to help people and businesses in the United States prepare for potential impacts on their lives and livelihoods. Empowering people with this information is key to our effort at NOAA to build a more weather-ready nation, one that is ready, responsive, and resilient to extreme weather and water events. The U.S. Spring Outlook includes three components: flood risk, predictions for temperature and precipitation through May, and an outlook for drought from April through June. But the big news this year is flooding. The major flooding we've already experienced across the lower Missouri and the middle to lower Mississippi Valley is a preview of what we expect through the rest of the spring. In fact, we expect the flooding will get worse and become more widespread. Hydrologists at our regional river forecast centers, along with our local weather forecast offices, have been supporting local decision makers to ensure community readiness ahead of this flooding. The stage is set for record flooding now through May, so communities in the high-risk threat areas need to prepare for impacts as the floodwaters move down the river systems. The Upper Mississippi and Red River of the North basins have received widespread rain and snow this spring, up to 200% of normal. The flooding this year could be worse than anything we've seen in recent years, even worse than the historic floods of 1993 and 2011. Ed will provide more details about the flood risk in just a moment, but first, I'd like to say a few words about NOAA's readiness for the flood threat we are facing. Our forecasters are delivering better-than-ever flood predictions, enabled by federal and state collaborations at the National Water Center in Tuscaloosa, Alabama. We officially opened the National Water Center in 2015, and today it serves as a catalyst for collaboration across the water resources enterprise and an operational forecasting hub across state and government water agencies. The National Water Center is enabling government, academic, and private sector water scientists to leverage shared information and skill to benefit public safety and better inform decisions which help the nation manage our water supply. One of the latest forecast tools available is our new National Water Model. The National Water Model uses data from more than 8,000 U.S. Geological Survey gauges to generate hourly forecast guidance for 5 million river miles in the contiguous United States. And the model is continually improving. Later this year, we will upgrade to version 2.0, which offers improved streamflow and snowpack guidance, ingredients we need to generate reliable water and flood forecasts. Moreover, this version 2.0 will mark the first OCONUS implementation of the National Water Model, as it will provide forecast guidance for the Hawaiian Islands. Remember, though public safety is the primary concern and focus, these river systems are linked together for commerce, so our decision support efforts extend to the transportation and commerce industries that rely on the nation's waterways to thrive. Flooding can cause more damage than any other weather-related event, with average damages of over $8 billion per year, according to statistics from FEMA and the National Flood Insurance Program. Flooding is also one of America's most underrated killers, causing nearly 100 fatalities per year, roughly half of which occur in vehicles. And flowing water can be particularly powerful and dangerous. Just 6 inches of water can sweep a person off their feet, and just 2 feet of rushing water can carry a mid-sized car downstream. Drivers should never attempt to cross a flooded roadway. Remember, our safety slogan is turn around, don't drown. Today, we thank each of you and the media for the valuable role that you play in communicating this important information to the public. We consider you to be a partner in helping us protect lives. With that, I'd like to introduce Ed Clark, director of the NOAA's National Water Center in Tuscaloosa, Alabama, to provide details of the spring flood risk. Ed?
Thank you, Mary, and good morning. I'll reiterate the takeaway from today's briefing and then announce the areas where we expect major flooding through the rest of the spring. Portions of the United States, especially in the upper Mississippi and Missouri River Valley, have already experienced record flooding due to early rapid snowmelt and heavy spring rains in areas where soil moisture is high. In some areas, ice jams are exacerbating the flooding. More than 200 million people are at risk for flooding in their communities, with 41 million at risk for moderate and 13 million at risk for major flooding. This is potentially an unprecedented flood season. The flooding we have seen in the past 2 weeks will continue through May and may become more dire in the coming weeks as these waters flow downstream. The impacts of this flooding will be extensive. We anticipate that nearly two-thirds of the lower 48 states will experience some level of flooding. We categorize flood risk as minor, moderate, major, and record flooding. See the news release for definitions of these categories, but in brief, minor flooding means that minimal or no property damage, but roads may be inundated. Moderate flooding means some inundation of structures and roads near streams. Major flooding means extensive inundation of structures and roads. And record flooding is when flooding exceeds or meets historical levels. The potential for major flooding is high along the following river basins in the Midwest and southern United States: the Red River of the North, the Mississippi, including the upper, middle, and lower portions of the system, the Missouri River main stem from Gavin's Point, South Dakota to Kansas City, Missouri, the Big Sioux, Vermilion Rivers, Lewis and Clark Lake, and the Lower James River in South Dakota, the Floyd, Ochidan, Rock, Big and Little Sioux Rivers in South Dakota and Iowa, the Wood River, Shell Creek, the Lower Platte, the Nishnabotna, and the North Fork Elkhorn River in Nebraska, the Tarkio, the Nishnabotna, and the Nodaway River basins in Missouri, the Platte River from Hastings, Nebraska to the confluence of the Missouri River. Other areas of these river basins are expected to experience minor to moderate flooding. In other portions of the country, we are forecasting minor to moderate flooding throughout a number of the nation's river basins due to higher than normal soil moisture and above normal winter and spring precipitation. These river basins are identified in our hydrologic assessment, which is linked in the news release at NOAA.gov, NOAA.gov. For much of the western United States, it is still too early to assess spring flood potential because of the continued snowfall in the upper elevations. The risk is high for flooding and debris flows, also called landslides, in areas where burn scars from recent wildfires in 2018 and 17 still remain. Heavy rainfall from thunderstorms and rapid warming could exacerbate this risk. Our hydrologic assessment also provides information about the nation's water supply forecast for agricultural, municipalities, and industrial uses. Water supply predictions are normal in many areas of the United States and near to well above normal, up to 200%, in portions of California. I encourage you to take a look at the hydrologic assessment for more details. And John Gottschalk will discuss water supply impacts further when he speaks to the drought outlook. Finally, our assessment also provides a first look at some of the major drivers influencing summer hypoxia in the Gulf of Mexico and Chesapeake Bay. Flood conditions will lead to higher than normal springtime discharges of nutrients and fresh water from the Mississippi River into the Gulf of Mexico. These conditions are conducive to hypoxia development, and it is predicted to lead to an above-average to large hypoxic zone in the Gulf of Mexico this summer. We expect an average hypoxia zone for the Chesapeake Bay, assuming typical summer precipitation. The public can determine whether their community is in a flood risk area by monitoring local flood conditions at water.weather.gov. This concludes the flood portion, and I will now turn it over to John to discuss the spring outlooks for temperature, precipitation, and drought. John?
Thanks, Ed, and good morning. The climate conditions we observed during the winter months set the stage for the spring temperature and precipitation outlooks. Above normal temperatures were observed for much of the continental United States during December and January. During February and March, however, tremendous cold impacted much of the western and north central United States. Above normal precipitation, including rain and snow, was persistent for much of the U.S., especially the northern and central plains and Mississippi Valley, where some areas received 200 or greater percent of their normal precipitation over this same period. In February, NOAA issued an El Nino advisory indicating that weak El Nino conditions are now present, with an 80% and 60% odds for these conditions to continue through the spring and summer, respectively. The development of El Nino conditions contributed to a very stormy pattern for California and much of the interior west during February and March. This pattern resulted in considerable drought relief for many areas of the west, including California, which is now drought-free for the first time in 7 years, since December 2011. The areas in the U.S. experiencing extreme drought are quite low and limited to northern New Mexico. So looking forward, NOAA's seasonal outlook for April through June favors warmer-than-average conditions for the Pacific Northwest and from southern Texas northward to the eastern Great Lakes and eastward to encompass the entire East Coast. The greatest odds for above-normal temperatures are for northern Alaska. Below-normal temperatures are favored for the northern and central plains. For April through June, above-normal precipitation is favored from the central Great Basin to the East Coast that may compound the flood risk for many states in the interior portion of the country. Below-normal precipitation is favored for the Alaska Panhandle and extreme Pacific Northwest. Drought conditions are forecast to continue to improve for remaining drought regions from Texas to southeast Oregon, while some drought development is possible for parts of the Pacific Northwest and Hawaii. That concludes my remarks, and I will turn it over to Dr. Konewski from FEMA to talk about how people can prepare for the springtime weather conditions.
Thank you, and thank you for the opportunity. Welcome from FEMA. We've seen a recent uptick in catastrophic disasters, including flooding recently. As a result, we have to change the way we think about them. Everybody in a community is responsible for being prepared for disasters. Flooding is the most common and costly disaster in the United States. And please don't assume that if you're outside the flood zone, that you're immune from flooding. Where it rains, it can flood. In the U.S., 98% of counties have experienced a flooding event. Now, insured survivors are able to recover more quickly and more fully from a flood or other catastrophic event than their uninsured neighbors. FEMA assistance to uninsured disaster survivors is a fraction of the assistance provided who have flood insurance. Now, most homeowners and renters' policies do not include flood insurance. Please visit floodsmart.gov or speak to your insurance agent, and note there's a 30-day waiting period for policies to take effect. In addition, when flooding and other disasters strike, alerts and warnings from local officials to the public saves lives. Now, we saw this recently in California with the wildfires. Now, every community across the country needs to be signed up for these alerts, and FEMA sponsors one program called the Integrated Public Alert and Warning System, or IPAWS. If you aren't sure if your local officials are signed up, please ask them. On our website, you'll find several IPAWS resources. In sum, here at FEMA, we're committed to closing the insurance gap, making sure that all communities are signed up for alerts and warnings, and that we are building a true culture of preparedness where every individual is taking responsibility to be ready when the next disaster strikes. With that, I'm going to give it back, I believe, to Lauren.
Thank you so much. Before we move on to the Q&A portion of our teleconference today, I want to introduce some of the other experts that we have on the call to take questions. First is Deke Arndt, Chief of the Monitoring Branch at NOAA's National Centers for Environmental Information. Second is David Miskis, Drought Meteorologist at NOAA's Climate Prediction Center. Next is Brad Rippey, a meteorologist from the U.S. Department of Agriculture who can address questions related to how the spring outlook may impact agriculture. And lastly, we're also joined by hydrologists from each of our 13 river forecast centers to provide insights into local flood risks around the country. As a reminder, when asking a question, please identify or address the specific expert on our panel you wish to answer your question. Operator, please let our reporters know how to get into the queue to ask their questions.
We will now begin our question and answer session. If you would like to ask a question, please press star 1 from your phone. Unmute your line and record your name clearly when prompted. If you would like to withdraw your question, please press star 2. One moment as we wait for our first question. And our first question comes from Beth Bornstein. Your line is now open.
Yes, it's Seth. Thank you. I guess this is for either for Ed or Mary. Just to put this in perspective again, I think you said that this could be worse than the 2003 and 2011 flooding, major floods. Is there, would that make it the, what are the chances that this will be the worst flooding event in the U.S.? Can we get some kind of what would be a best analog for this? And are we seeing more major flooding events in the U.S. and why?
So, Seth, I will answer the first part of that question.
Okay.
Right now, the conditions are primed across the country for above average risk of major flooding. The driver of that will be a function of how quickly the snow melt in the northern portion of the country releases and any additional rains that may fall through the spring season. It's still too early to characterize whether this year will be an absolute record and in which basins. And for that reason, we continue to monitor and work with our 13 river forecast centers and 122 river weather forecast offices to day by day, hour by hour, assess that risk. In terms of the climate change portion of the question, I will defer to Deke.
Hi, Seth. This is Deke Arndt from NCEI in Asheville. Flooding is complex, and it has to do with precipitation falling on the ground, but also with the way that water is managed and the surface hydrology, how it flows across the land and is collected and runs off. So I can speak to the precipitation piece of that. And what we are seeing in general, especially east of the Rockies, are that large doses of rain tend to be increasing with some regional and seasonal exceptions. And the overall amount of precipitation in the form of rain or snow is in general increasing, again, with some seasonal and regional exceptions. The management of water and the surface hydrology is a complicating factor. Flooding is a complex phenomenon involving more than just how much rain or precipitation falls. But those factors tend to be increasing in the U.S., the rainfall factors, especially east of the Rockies.
And I'm just trying to figure, what is the worst year for flooding on record? I mean, I know it's, you know, a lot depends on definition, but what would be the sort of the high water mark, if you pardon the pun?
Thanks, Seth. So that's a relatively difficult question to answer. The impacts of floods are profoundly local. We have some experience as far back as 1927, the year that drove the development of the Army Corps of Engineers flood protection system across the center portion of the country. But again, each flood is profoundly impactful to those that experience it. And it's hard to put particularly as communities evolve, as the floodplain changes, it's hard to assess in a historical context which season was the most impactful for the most number of citizens.
Thank you.
Our next question comes from Brian Sullivan. Your line is now open.
Hi there. Thanks for doing this. Couple of questions. One is, how is the damage from the floods that have already occurred going to make things worse or potentially better going forward? And are there any what river has the highest risk? Is it the Mississippi, the Missouri, the Ohio?
So, Brian, I'll turn that over to Kevin Lowe, who's Missouri Basin River Forecast Center, has been experiencing the brunt of the record flooding. In terms of which portion of the country, that should be answered by a combination of both Kevin and Corey Loveland from the North Central River Forecast Center. Gentlemen?
Good morning. I guess I'll go ahead and get started. My name is Kevin Lowe. I'm with the Missouri Basin River Forecast Center in Kansas City. We've already experienced, over the past week, we've already experienced historic flooding on the, well, we've set over 30 records in Nebraska, Iowa, and South Dakota. We've set three new records on the Missouri River itself, below Gavin's Point Dam. Gavin's Point Dam is the most downstream reservoir on the main stem Missouri River, and we've set three new records this past week on it. So the Missouri River from Gavin's Point and Yankton, South Dakota, to the mouth in St. Louis remains vulnerable. We currently have major level flooding north of Kansas City or upstream of Kansas City, and the whole stretch remains vulnerable to moderate flooding for the remainder of the spring and early summer. Right now, particular concerns are the Big Sioux River in South Dakota and the James and Vermilion Rivers in South Dakota. Those three basins, within the Missouri River Basin anyway, those three basins stand the greatest chance of seeing major to possibly record flooding over the next 2 to 4 weeks. Some locations will actually crest this coming week. I hope that answers your question, sir. Mm-hmm.
So this is Corey Loveland. I'm the Service Coordination Hydrologist for the North Central River Forecast Center. And unlike Kevin, he's, I guess what was mentioned before, they're kind of in the midst of the flooding now. Our flooding season has started as of about over the weekend with the onset of widespread rain, which melted a lot of the snow, also a little bit of an increase in temperatures as well. Our concerns right now are mostly the upper Mississippi River Basin and primarily the tributaries that flow into the upper Mississippi, primarily the Minnesota and the Rock River right now, and possibly later the Illinois River as well. Right now we have dry weather in the forecast, but that's not to say that we're over anything. We're gearing up mainly for widespread flooding, which could happen from now through at least the month of May, depending on really the wild card of the spring precipitation and the temperatures in the near term here. So I guess in a nutshell, most of our concerns, most of our concerns, again, are in the Mississippi, and there's a lot of preparations in the emergency management realm. As far as sandbagging and shoring up levees and other structures to contain a lot of this water, because like everyone has mentioned, that we have a lot of snow yet to melt. Hopefully that answers your question from my end.
And as a reminder, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star 1 from your phone. Our next question comes from Jeff Martin. Your line is now open.
Thank you. My question is about the situation a little bit further downstream. I wondered if you could give us a very general timeline of when some of the worst flooding might hit Memphis, for instance, and when it might hit Baton Rouge. And then in addition to that, I wondered how late could this flooding last into the spring, or could it go into the summer?
Great. Thank you for your question. I will turn this over to Jeff Graschel, the Service Coordination Hydrologist at the Lower Mississippi River Forecast Center. Jeff?
All right. Thanks, Ed. Jeff, we've actually had some of our highest water a little bit earlier in the month over the Memphis area, and that was really due to the 10 to 15 inches of rainfall that we had over the Tennessee Valley and Ohio Valley back in February. We've actually receded some from those higher levels that we had earlier in the month around Memphis. And right now we just have very slow falls occurring at this time. All the historic rainfall that you're seeing over in Nebraska and the Missouri area and the flooding that you're seeing in portions of Iowa and Minnesota are still working their way down the portions of the Mississippi. The one fortunate thing is that we've had pretty good falls on the Ohio and the Tennessee and the Cumberland rivers. So with the Mississippi and the Ohio coming together at Cairo, Illinois, we're really not seeing any more rises based on the snowmelt and the historic rainfall at this time. The big keys for us is going to be any of the additional rainfall that we may get in the coming months. So we're certainly going to have high water for the next couple of months just because we're still got very high water level conditions and stuff on the lower part of the river. And specifically speaking for Baton Rouge, we're still actually cresting now from the water that we had in late February and early March. So really the highest levels that we're seeing on at Baton Rouge are occurring right now. But we do foresee that things should start to fall slowly over the next several weeks. And again, just for us, it'll be the additional rainfall that we get in the coming months. So that will really determine whether we exceed the levels that we currently have on the lower part of the river.
Thank you very much.
Operator, if we could take our next question.
Our next question comes from John Schwartz. Your line is now open.
Thanks for having this call. What are the parallels here, and this is a little bit following along Seth's question, what are the parallels here to the predictions of what we could expect from climate changes laid out in documents like the National Climate Assessment Volume 2, which is pretty specific on these parts of the country? Can you sort of go into that and draw the parallels? Whoever would be doing that?
Hi, this is Dee Garn again from NCEI in Asheville. The situation that's going on in the Midwest and the upper Midwest is a complex one, and any of the hydrologists could probably speak to the details much better than I could. But from what I understand, the major factors in this event, in addition to be a very wet late winter season, lots of snow on the ground, and the rain falling on the snow, and the frozen ground basically not allowing the infiltration and all of the runoff staying above the surface. In a climate context, in the long term, that is an astoundingly complex situation. So drawing a parallel between this specific event and what we might expect in the future is going to take a lot of homework in an emerging field that we call attribution science, you know, which is basically asking the question of where does this big event fit into what we know and expect in a changing climate. The first factor, the heavy precipitation that immediately led to the floods, that is something, like we shared with Seth, that is generally increasing over time. Those other hydrological factors, the details that the hydrologists on this call have to deal with constantly, are less directly kind of accessed in that way in that science. So I'm sorry for kind of a long, drawn-out non-answer, but I think that this event that's going on, first of all, is terribly unfortunate, but hopefully on the backside of it, we can inform the science and do a better job of placing it into what we expect in a changing climate, but its complexity means that there's going to need to be a lot of homework done between now and when we can give a definitive answer.
Well, thank you. I asked the question because it's complex.
it's definitely complex.
What does this mean in terms of activation of little-used tools like the Bird's Point floodway? Are y'all gearing up in any way for possibilities like that?
So this is Ed Clark. That decision is really made in conjunction with the Army Corps of Engineers. I'll defer to my colleagues both in North Central and the Lower Mississippi, but my expectation is that it's still too early in the season, particularly because we haven't seen those heavy rains yet materialize for those conversations to be ongoing. But either Jeff or Kevin or Jim Knoll, would you like to offer any insight?
Yeah, this is Jeff at the Lower Mississippi River Forecast Center. Yeah, it's certainly just a monitoring right now and stuff. Right now, there's no projections for operating Birds Point to Madrid. Level conditions are low enough to that there's no need for the floodway to be operated this time. But certainly, the Corps of Engineers and the Weather Service will be monitoring that over the next several months and stuff too. And really, it's dependent on the rainfall that we may get over the next couple of months to determine those decisions.
Thanks very much.
And as a reminder, if you'd like to ask a question, you may press star one from your phone. Our next question comes from Timothy Gardner. Your line is now open.
Oh, hi. This is just a follow-up on the questions about climate. I mean, you know, scientists tell us that a warmer atmosphere holds more water. It's a simple, it's a basic physics, you know, phenomena. So just wondered if you could tell us if climate is. I mean, I appreciate your long answer and that it's complex, but is it in this instance at least playing a supporting role? I mean, there must be other factors, including land use change and levees deteriorating, but isn't it at least a supporting role?
Hi, this is Deke again. Diagnosing a single event and kind of framing the role that climate change played in an event is still an emerging piece of this relatively immature discipline called attribution science, which is really promising. In many ways, trying to determine the role that climate change played in an event while the event is still playing out is a fool's errand, and it's almost like trying to describe the cause of a car wreck while the cars are still spinning. So we can speak to this in generalities, which are that we do see increased precipitation. We do see increased dosing of precipitation, especially east of the Rockies in the U.S. But many of these other factors are unusual and rare enough, and especially the combination of those factors are unusual and rare enough that it becomes very difficult to fit those into a definitive statement about climate change. So again, I apologize for the relatively long answer, but the hydrology piece of the flooding that's going on in the Midwest is quite unusual, or at least a relatively unusual combination of factors that led to this.
Thanks. And what about like land use change? Is that also helping to make this worse?
So I'm going to defer to any of our hydrologists on that piece of the question because they're more equipped to answer that than me.
Thanks, Timothy. This is Ed Clark. As Deke said, that too, the changes in the landscape, whether it be the installation of drain tiles, change in crop cycles, and increasing urbanization, that again, not to give a long-winded non-answer to your question, but the attribution of those specific changes at the specific county or square mile by square mile basis is really beyond the capabilities that we have here within the National Weather Service. I will defer to folks in North Central River Forecast Center and Missouri Basin if they can offer insight on what they've seen in their careers. But again, the attribution science for particular land use changes at this particular county township scale, which is really where these floods are being driven from, is very hard to tease out.
Thank you.
And as a reminder, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star 1 from your phone. Our next question comes from Brian Sullivan. Your line is now open.
Hey, thanks. I'm taking a second chance here. How did last year's wet weather contribute to this, and potentially what caused it? And secondly, I have a question for Brad. We talked a little about agriculture yesterday, but how does this look for agriculture nationwide going forward?
John Gottrick, I don't know if you want to speak to what we saw from a climate perspective over the last year.
Sure. This is John Gottrick from the Climate Prediction Center. It's a very good point you make, Brian, in the sense that the persistent above-average precipitation that we've seen actually dating back, as you mentioned, all the way back well into 2018 has been incredibly persistent across much of the continental United States. And what made this particular situation, I feel, so dire is that not only was the whole winter above average from California into the Intermountain West and through much of the central and eastern part of the country, was that a lot of that very active storm track and storm active pattern in general occurred during the late winter months, during February, and has persisted into early March. At the same time, we had a very cold air mass, as many folks know, that entered the Pacific Northwest and part much of the West. And so a lot of that precipitation in northern areas ended up building up the snowpack as well. So a combination of those factors of our long-term above-average precipitation dating back to last year, and also the very strong increase in precipitation and cold weather in the western and central United States really set the stage, I think, in many ways for the high soil moisture, positive soil moisture anomalies we see across much of the country, as well as the higher snowpack and some of the higher latitudes.
And then can we go to Brad Rippey?
Brad, are you there to take the second part of that question?
You're on mute.
We may have lost him. We'll follow up with you on that question. I'm sorry about that.
Our next question comes from Susan Wood. Your line is now open.
Hi, this question is for Dan. Hi, Dan. I'm going to take this conversation to the West. I am interested in knowing, I want to talk about extremes, because the West, as you know, in the Sierra Nevada, we've had unprecedented snow this year. The last California Department of Water Resources snowpack has reported 153% of normal, and with another snow survey coming up. Okay, so that water's got to go, that water content in that snowpack has to go somewhere. So, and in addition, as it pertains to the Bay Area, the San Francisco Bay Area, areas in the Bay Area also saw unprecedented rainfall, especially in the North Bay. And then combined with very cold temperatures, I mean, Mount Hamilton is a 4,500-foot peak and received 38 inches of snowfall, which is unprecedented in itself. Now, what I want to talk about as it relates to FEMA is the fact that firefighters in a no-win situation are constantly concerned that they either have drought conditions, in which case the fuel is timber dry, or what happens when we have this kind of unprecedented winter into the spring, and then what it usually results in is everything is growing. So when you have more growth, you have more fuel, which means we're going to have the possibility is very clear that we could have another one of these horrible fire seasons. So what I'm wondering is whether FEMA is, bracing for that kind of season. And actually, feel free, anybody, to jump in here and contribute.
Well, thank you. This is Dan from FEMA. Well, I was out in California, Northern California, actually, about 2 weeks ago. I was there for a discussion with state and local officials on wildfire prevention, wildfire detection, wildfire response. And many of the topics you mentioned were on our agenda. It was, the irony was not lost on me that we were doing this discussion on wildfires at the same time that there was significant flooding in that area. So I agree with you that there are a variety of hazards that California faces, some of them as different as fire and water, right? But the reality of the situation is that FEMA is committed to investing now to reduce the impacts of these disasters, whatever they may be, for the future. In our parlance, that's mitigation, right? That's investing in communities, investing in public infrastructure in ways that will strengthen those communities, strengthen that infrastructure so that it can withstand those impacts. Now, as a result of these catastrophic disasters that California has faced, there's a significant amount of money, hundreds of millions of dollars, available to the state of California now to invest in mitigation projects. And we fully expect that they will make those investments in a wise way to again, reduce the impacts. In addition, we've been recently authorized by Congress to have a nationwide risk-based competitive mitigation program that will position FEMA to assist all states, not just those that are hit by disasters. And for those of you that know anything about FEMA mitigation dollars, the vast majority is available to states only after a disaster has struck. So we are very grateful to Congress for this new program that will enhance our pre-disaster mitigation efforts.
Our next question comes from Jennifer Herriger. Your line is now open.
Operator, let's move on to the next question.
Our next question comes from Jennifer Herriger. Your line is now open. Our next question comes from Burton. Your line is now open. One moment.
Operator, are you there? Are we able to continue with our question?
One moment, please.
This is Brad Rippey from USDA. If you can hear me now, I can answer Brian's question from a couple of questions ago.
That would be great.
All right. So, Brian, I apologize for the technical problems, but let me get to your question about planting and agriculture in 2019. And certainly we do have some cards stacked against us across roughly the western half of the Corn Belt right now due to excessive soil moisture, and in the far northern areas still snow to melt off, including the Red River Valley. But I do want to caution, it is still late March. And if you remember just a year ago in 2018, we saw an incredibly cold and snowy April, and then a switch flipped right around the 1st of May, and an incredible amount of corn and soybeans were planted in a short period of time. So we had a compressed planting season in 2018. Almost two-thirds of the corn planted in 3 weeks ending May 20th. Almost two-thirds of the U.S. soybeans planted in 3 weeks ending May 27th. So a lot can change in a short period of time. And even though we are expecting to see some delays in the wettest areas on the front end, that, again, can change just based on day-to-day weather patterns. So we'll have to wait and see how things play out in April and May.
Our next question comes from Jennifer Herriger. Your line is now open.
Hi, can you guys hear me?
Yes, thank you.
All right, perfect. So we're up here in Vermont and northern New York. Last year we had some pretty bad ice jam flooding. We're wondering, since we've got a pretty good amount of snowpack, do you guys expect to see any of that coming up in the future here for us?
Well, I'm going to redirect that to my friend and colleague, Ed Capone, up there at the Northeast River Forecast Center. Ed?
This is Ed from the Northeast River Forecast Center. With the upcoming event this weekend, we don't expect to see any problems with that. You're going to build a snowpack in the high basins of the Adirondacks and Champlain. So we don't see that in the short term. In the longer term, we're really interested in looking at the weather pattern for a very warm and very wet condition there. And that we'll have to look at the next 2 to 4 weeks.
Perfect. Thank you.
Our next question comes from Kenneth Medley. Your line is now open.
Question is for Ed Clark and Deke in Asheville. We've already had higher than normal rain through the winter in February over in Johns City, Tennessee, which is right across the border from Asheville, North Carolina. We've seen some mudslides and stuff as a result of that. And going forward, what's the likelihood that the flooding is going to be on the higher end of the minor scale, and what factors would kind of push it a little over the edge to become more major flooding and serious events?
Thanks, Kenneth. I'm actually going to turn that over to Jeff Grashel at the Lower Mississippi River Forecast Center, who actually forecasts for that area as well as the main.
Okay.
Hi, Kenneth. This is Jeff Grashel. Yeah, it's really going to be dependent on what kind of rainfall that we get over the next couple of months across that area. As you well know, we had almost annual record rainfalls over portions of the Tennessee Valley for last year, and then that continued through the early part of this winter and into spring. So it's really going to be dependent on individual rain events that we have in that area, since really that kind of drives the factors and the impacts that we get in your area for the type of flooding that we see. So it's really going to be dependent on the rainfall that we get and how heavy it'll be.
Can you answer one more question? It's is there going to be any likelihood of some localized flash flooding from major rain events?
Well, that certainly could be a possibility over the next couple of months. Obviously, the soil moisture conditions are very wet, and we have a lot of your area has receded from the previous rainfalls that we had in February and March, as you well know. But certainly, rainfall that we get in the springtime can be quite heavy at times, and certainly that possibility is there.
All right. Thank you all for taking the question.
Operator, if we could take one last question.
Our next question comes from Judson Jones. Your line is now open.
Brandon Miller from CNN. And we were wondering, with the warmer temperatures expected in the eastern third of the country and cooler temperatures expected in the Great Plains, what that could mean for severe weather season, for the tornado season, which has already been off to a pretty busy start, especially with El Nino in place, what that could likely mean. Thank you.
So I'll direct this one to John Gottschalk at CPC. John?
Thanks, Ed. Yeah, the general feeling is that more of the south-central U.S., from my understanding, would be more on the end of potential higher activity with severe weather. With respect to a pattern such as that we have forecast for the spring with colder temperatures more across parts of the central part of the country and warmer to the east, that certainly could favor more of an active storm track or barophonicity across parts of the Ohio Valley and into the plains. But it's very difficult to say with overall in general, because those events could be very much localized from day to day or from week to week overall. But it would certainly favor some potential there. But it's hard to say.
And our next question comes from Robert Henson. Your line is now open.
Yes. Hi there. Thank you so much for doing this call. I had a question about the spring flood outlook graphic, and in particular, I'm wondering whether the area marked as major in the Missouri Valley incorporates what's already happened there the last few days. In other words, does it reflect the risk going forward from today, or does it also incorporate what's already happened?
Thank you, Robert. It does. The answer is yes, and I will turn it over to Kevin Lau to explain a little bit more about where they're seeing which portions of that that widespread major risk for flooding this spring that they anticipate that will continue over the next couple of weeks. Kevin?
Okay, thank you, and thank you for bringing that up. So in South Dakota, we still have the likelihood of seeing minor or moderate to major flooding in South Dakota, Iowa as well, or western Iowa, the Missouri portion of that. And the Missouri River itself, from Gavin's Point to St. Louis, with the conditions that now reside with levees and so forth, I would recommend that people be on people be prepared for major flooding along the Missouri River as well going into the future. For the remainder of the basin, I do not expect major flooding at this point. So, again, to recap, South Dakota, Iowa, and portions of the state of Missouri, including the main stem Missouri, should all be prepared for the likelihood or at least the possibility of major flooding again going forward. I hope that answers your question.
Okay, yeah. So, in other words, the middle, say, northeast Nebraska area may not be as vulnerable given that it's already gone through this major flooding now. I guess I'm just wondering to what extent the risk has been sort of discharged by what's already happened.
Yes, sir. That is exactly right. Yeah. The state of Nebraska, I don't see any locations in the state of Nebraska that have a likelihood of seeing major again. With the exception of the main stem, Missouri River itself. But the other tributaries within the state of Nebraska are not likely to experience major flooding again this season.
Okay, thank you very much.
This concludes the question and answer session of our conference. I'd like to turn it back over to Lori.
Thank you so much. That concludes our media teleconference for today. I want to thank all of our participants who dialed in today from our partner agencies at FEMA and the USDA and across NOAA at the National Water Center, the National Centers for Environmental Information, the Climate Prediction Center, and the Regional River Forecast Centers. If anyone has any additional questions or follow-ups, please do not hesitate to reach out to me, as we have experts on site at both the National Water Center in Tuscaloosa and our College Park, Maryland location for follow-ups. Again, my email is lauren.gacious@noaa.gov. That information is also located on the press release or your media advisory. And I can be reached via phone at 301-683-1327. If you don't already have it, the news release with the outlook and the flood risk maps are available on noaa.gov. And the audio from this call will also be made available online. I thank you so much for your participation today.
Thank you for your participation in today's conference. All parties may disconnect at this time. Leaders, please stand by.